For a long time, when people studied history, they studied the doings of nobles and kings and an occasional soldier, and that was the content of historical study. And at a certain point over the last century and a half, people began to be interested in those people that no one was interested in. What about the commoner? What about the farmer? What about what the poet Gray called the short and simple annals of the poor? Weren't their lives as complex, as rich, and as interesting as people who wielded power? I remember when I was at the seminary and we were studying the history of the Jews of the Inquisition, and I wanted to write my paper on Abravanel, and I said to my professor, Professor Gampel, I said, it's so interesting to me to think here's this guy who gets exiled, steps off a ship, having left everything that he's known and loved and the country that he served. And he said to me, actually, he doesn't interest me nearly as much as the guy who got off the ship after him that nobody knew and nobody greeted and nobody thought was a great honor to have in their country. What was his experience as opposed to the experience of Abravanel, whom everyone greeted with open arms and whose sadness is chronicled throughout Jewish history? And that tendency, that is to examine the lives of people whose lives have gone unexamined, has also made a profound impact on the study of the Torah. The other day I received a novel that somebody wanted me to blurb, to make a comment on, called Noah's Wife. We don't know anything about Noah's wife, not even her name. But surely she did at least some of the cleaning in the ark, which I'm guessing was a bigger job than anything Noah ever had to do. And isn't it interesting to imaginatively project yourself into her experience when her husband comes home one day and says, it's time to build an ark because God's going to flood the world. And so this morning, which is the parsha of Abraham's journey and his command, which we spoke about earlier, for those of you who were in the Torah study, about whether it is an external command or an internal command. But remember that I said, despite the fact that Lech Lecha is singular, he takes Sarah. So what's her experience? What does this woman think and feel as she not only goes to Canaan, a place amorphously designated, as you've heard, a place I will show you? And how many wives have heard that from their husbands? Just come with me, I'll show you where we're going. Not a problem. I know the directions. I won't get lost. But also when Abraham twice passes her off as his sister, manages, after almost a century of being married, to finally notice that she's pretty, and lives an essentially silent life despite some small glimpses into her character, what was her experience? And the first thing to mention is how profoundly she affected the people that we do study. Remember, we talk about Jacob all the time. She was Jacob's grandmother. The stories of your grandmother, whether you ever met her or not, think of how potent and powerful they are in families. But how often when we study Jacob do we think, I wonder if he was affected by his grandmother? But once we return ourselves to the reality of the family dynamic and we think about what Sarah went through and what she felt and who she was, and we think about the effect that our own mothers and grandmothers have had in our lives, all of a sudden, it takes on a different perspective. I've told you the story before of I.I. Rabi, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who, when he was asked in Haaretz in an interview before he passed away, who was the most important influence in your life? And he didn't say Einstein, and he didn't say Bohr, and he didn't say any of his teachers, he said my mother. Because every morning when I would go to cheder, when I would go to religious school, she would say to me, Yitzi, did you ask any good questions today? And from her I learned, he said, that the secret to knowledge was asking the right questions. Now, had he not said that, there'd be lots of biographies about him, articles, comments, and no one would say, you know, he owes it to his mother. Surely Yitzhak had some ambivalent feelings about the father who took him up to the mountain to bind him and slaughter him. And you may know that after the Akedah, Isaac and Abraham never speak again. But remember what it says when Isaac finds Rivka, that he is comforted for the loss of his mother. So we can only imagine what was the pain that he felt when he lost Sarah. It was Sarah who was his fierce defender, after all. It was Sarah who stuck with his father, not only through that long journey from Ur Kasdim all the way to Canaan, but also down to Egypt, who put up with being cast off twice and returned, who wanted so badly to give Abraham a son that she had that somewhat misfired attempt to give him her handmaiden so that he would have a child, only to discover not so long after that she was pregnant, which threw the whole house into chaos. And remember also that Sarah isn't visited by an angel when she is about to give birth. It says, God took note of Sarah. Hashem pakad at Sarah. That's why in our Amidah, which I am going to come to in a moment, we say, Magen Abraham poked Sarah. It's true. If you grow up with the traditional Amidah, it is very strange to include the names of the mothers. Where did they come from, after all? Elohei Abraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, that we're comfortable with. That's what most of us grew up with. But all of a sudden, you've got Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah in there. But once you realize that the truth is that Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were probably at least as influenced, or perhaps more influenced, by Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah than they were by each other, then you say, how come they weren't there already? How is it that we managed to weave a tapestry of our history in which the voices of our mothers are absent? How is it that we don't know that, according to the rabbis, do you know why the Jews merited manna in the wilderness? Because of the cakes that Sarah baked for the angels when they visited her house. It wasn't the men who brought the manna. It was the merit of Sarah. The thing that strikes me about the women in the Torah is that one of the reasons why their emotional life is not described, although the emotional life of men is rarely described as well, is because it eludes words. Because the heart of women is more complex, more deep feeling, more easily hurt, more uncertainly healed, as a general rule, than the hearts of most men. And so you can describe the externals of a man's life and feel like you have some grasp of what's going on inside of him. But it's almost as if the Torah throws its hands up in despair to tell us what Rachel and Leah felt when they were competing over the same man and they were sisters and he loved one and the other has children. Tolstoy wouldn't be subtle enough to describe that one. And so it says, here is Sarah, but you will have to imagine the vicissitudes of her heart, given all the many things she endures, because there are no words to describe it. But sometimes, when something is too difficult to describe, we tend to ignore it. And I think it is time to restore Sarah's heart, but not only hers, to the center of our tradition. And to remember, in our own experience, the home that we grew up in, and the tone that was set, that was true in ancient times as well. For the formative years of a child's life, and we know now, even though we intuited it, that the formative years of anyone's life are early years. That what happens to you at 30 is not going to be as impactful as what happens to you at 4, even if you don't remember the latter and you remember the former. But those early years, who shapes us? Who made Joseph into a dreamer and Yaakov into a fighter? My guess, unscientific, unproven, but I think a pretty good one, their mothers. And so, when we talk about the mission, let's remember, Abraham's name is changed from Abram to Abraham because God says, you will be the father of many nations. Sarai is changed to Sarah. First of all, by the way, you wonder where the Yud went. The rabbis tell us it migrated. Yehoshua was originally Hoshea. The Yud went in front of Yehoshua's name and he became Yehoshua, which means that the leader that brought the Israelites into Israel, he began his name with Sarah's gift. But notice that Sarai turns to Sarah not because she's going to become the mother of many nations, but rather those are two different names of God. The Yud is one name of God, and the He is another name of God. So who brought God into the house of Yitzchak? Maybe Abraham bought national consciousness and the idea that there would be a great nation and there would be like the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea, but when it came to bringing spirit down, that was Sarah. So on this Shabbat, when all across the world Jews are talking about the mission of Abraham, let's remember that there is no mission of Abraham without the heart of Sarah. And that she should be in our prayers and in our thoughts, as all of our mothers have been throughout the generations. There is no grand declaration from Sarah. No dramatic act on the order of taking Isaac up to the mountain. And yet, in 2 weeks, unlike Abraham, we read a parsha that is named for her. Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah. And you will remember that even though every section of the Torah refers to itself, it also refers to Jewish history for all time. So Chaye Sarah is not only about her life, it's also about the reality that all of us are still living Chaye Sarah. That the legacy that she gave, some of which is articulated and some of which is buried but powerful, moves through us. Our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, on and on and on, back to the very first. We are their legacy. And their love is our future. So next time you hear Lech Lecha, remember that the command wasn't only given to Abraham, and that without Sarah, he never would have made it, and neither would we. Shabbat Shalom.